It's the Bengal Financial Literacy Show coming up next on KISU FM Radio with our host, Chris Chatwin, professor with the Idaho State University College of Business.
Thank you for joining us for this month's podcast of the Bengal Financial Literacy Show. I am your host, Chris Chatwin, coming to you from KISU Studio at Idaho State University. Have with us our guest today, Ken Franklin, a certified financial planner. Ken, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Chris.
So Ken is also an ISU alum, which we love. Ken, maybe right off the bat, maybe just tell us who you are. I said certified financial planner. What is a CFP? What do people need to know about that?
Good question, Chris. So Ken Franklin, I attended Idaho State University from 1996 to 2001 and was fortunate enough to get a double major in finance and management. Really had an awesome time at Idaho State University, and it really set me up to get into the financial services career and eventually became a certified financial planner. And great question, what is a certified financial planner? Well, you may have heard of other designations like CFA, Certified Financial Analyst, Certified Financial Planner, all kinds of different designations and professions out there. But a certified financial planner is someone that will help you plan your future, manage your investments, manage everything financial within your life, and hold you accountable to the goals that you want to accomplish. And often I'm asked why work with a certified financial planner. Maybe I already have a financial professional, but he's not a certified financial planner. Like, what does that mean exactly? Well, a certified financial planner has gone through the diligence of getting certified, and it's about a three-year program, and it goes through six different modules that cover finances and all kinds of different finances, from estate planning to managing investments to how to give financial advice. But most importantly, certified financial planners have to follow the code of ethics. They're bound to that. And the code of ethics is, number one, act with honesty, integrity, competence, and diligence. So that's pretty important. Number two, act in the client's best interests. So they always have to put their client's best interest in front of their own. Number three, exercise due care. Number four, avoid or disclose any and manage any conflicts of interest. So if there's any conflicts of interest whatsoever, you have to be a certified financial planner is required to disclose that. And we do our best to avoid any conflicts of interest. Number five, maintain the confidentiality and protect the privacy of client information. So it's kind of like an attorney-client privilege. That's what you can expect with working with a certified financial planner. And we are required to act in a manner that reflects positively on the financial planning profession and CFP certification. So we all have to make each other look good.
Yeah, which is a good thing, right? If obviously, if you're acting unethically, that just doesn't just reflect on you, but the entire profession. So
exactly.
All good things. So obviously the great benefit of a CFP, you mentioned that education requirement, those certifications you go through, allows you to do much more than just, say, recommend an investment for a client, but be able to help them with all aspects of their financial life.
Exactly. Exactly.
Which is exactly why we have you here today. So we just completed the first annual, and I say first annual because we hope to make it an annual event, the first annual Bengal Financial Literacy Week here at Idaho State University. We hope to do this every April. And we did have you here as our keynote speaker. So first keynote speaker of all time for the Financial Literacy Week. And while you're here, your keynote address was the 10 financial planning principles you need to know. And so because obviously we want to get those 10 key things out to everyone, this won't be as long as the keynote address that you gave to us while you were here on campus, but want to talk about those 10 things and help our listeners to understand, hey, here's some of the things you need to be thinking about. So
yeah, and since this is a little different format, we're on the radio and we can't share slides or anything like that. I'm going to touch on the 10 different financial planning principles that people need to know. And I'd like to say that I've been a financial planner now for 22 years, and I took a lot of the learnings that I took over the past 22 years and condensed them into the top 10 financial planning principles. And hopefully everyone gets a good takeaway from some of these.
Excellent. Well, let's dive right in. What is number one?
Well, number one is investing in yourself. So in keeping in mind, I was talking to mostly college students. I thought I'd give them an example of why investing in yourself is a great financial planning principle, because the average lifetime earnings, statistically, of someone with a high school diploma is about $1.2 million. So they can expect to earn $1.2 million over the course of their lifetime with inflation protection built in over the course of, say, age 20 to age 65. So oftentimes our income is our biggest asset. But if you get a bachelor's degree, that amount almost doubles, to $2.5 million. And going on to get a professional degree on average is has three times the average lifetime earnings of someone with no high school diploma at $3.8 million. So no high school diploma, 1.2, bachelor's degree, 2.5, and professional degree, $3.8 million average lifetime earnings. So investing in yourself is really important.
So education, obviously, I think with education, as we see now, the battle over, you know, student loan forgiveness, education is important, but maybe having an idea of what you're studying and why you're studying it probably, I think, fits into that, does it not, that investing in yourself?
Yeah, I believe so. And not necessarily, a lot of people go on to careers that don't follow the majors that they followed, of course, but a lot of people do. And proving that you can finish something and obtaining knowledge is really valuable to yourself later in life, and mostly to your employers too.
Perfect. Well, what about number two? What do we have for number two?
Number two is starting early. So again, we're talking to college kids, and I had some people say, well, what if I didn't get a chance to start early? Well, it's never too late, but here's an example of starting early. And I'm going to use my two fictional characters, Sarah and Jim.
Okay.
And Sarah started at age 22. So she graduated from Idaho State University, got a good job, and is saving $2,000 a year into an investment account. And she decided to save from ages 22 to 30 and then stopped saving.
Okay. So save for a few years, but then stopped, whatever reason.
Yeah. So she decided to save from 22 to 30. She only saved for 8 years, full of $16,000. That's all she saved. But she stopped and just let that lump sum of money grow. Versus Jim, who decided he had a lot of time on his side. So he said, I can just wait. I can put this off a little bit. And Jim actually saved from age 30 to age 60. So Jim actually saved for 30 years and put in a total of $60,000 into his investment, whereas Sarah had only invested $2,000 a year for eight, only $16,000. And if we fast forward to age 60, and assuming their investments earn an average rate of return of 8%, you got to wonder who had more money. And actually, Sarah had significantly more money. So even though she saved for 8 years and then stopped, at age 60, she had $291,000, whereas Jim only had $226,000. So it's a really great example of the power of compounding interest and why starting early is really in your best interest.
Yeah, certainly a principle I hit on with my students quite a bit in our personal finance course. When we talk time value of money, the most powerful tool in that is time. Mm-hmm. So the earlier you start, the better chance you have, even if it's a little bit. I mean, we've got college students or maybe even recent grads that, you know, maybe they can't save a whole lot right now. That's understandable. But mm-hmm. by starting early, not only do you start to build that wealth, but you also start to build the habit. And I think that's probably one of the most powerful things that comes out of that.
Yeah, agreed. Very agreed. And hopefully those first two are pretty motivating. But I think something that needs to be said is the third one, which is set clear financial goals. A lot of times people say, I just want to do better, or I want to retire sometime, or
I want to be rich.
I want to be rich. But those sound like great goals, but they're most likely not going to be achieved because they don't follow the SMART set of principles for setting clear financial goals. So SMART, a goal to give yourself the best chance of achieving a goal, it number one needs to be specific, measurable, achievable, realistic and time bound. So instead of saying I want to retire someday, a better goal would be to say I would like to retire at age 65 with $100,000 a year of income, and here's what I'm going to be able to save: $700 a month to be able to get there, and my investments need to earn an average rate of return of 6%. That's a very specific, measurable, achievable, realistic, time-bound goal. And the chances of accomplishing that goal go up significantly when it's smart.
So when I'm specific about it, when I know how to measure it, you know, when it's achievable, attainable, realistic, and when I've got a time constraint on it, whether it's financial or anything else, that goal is, as you mentioned, far more likely to be achieved. I'm going to actually track it. I'm going to pay attention to it. And I'm going to work towards it.
Very good summary. The fourth financial planning principle is creating a budget. So I'm always surprised how many people can actually get by without creating a budget, but it's simply knowing how much money you have coming in versus how much is going out. Cool. So an easy way to do that is to write it down on a piece of paper, create an Excel spreadsheet. There's tons of apps and software that can help you accomplish this, but creating a budget helps you do a couple things. It helps you understand if there's money left over at the end of the month, or if there's month left over at the end of the money.
I like that saying.
Yeah, so we really want to have money left over at the end of the month. And another great reason for creating a budget is because if you know how much money you have going out on a monthly basis, that's also a great way to establish how much your cash reserves needs to be. So for example, if you have $2,000 a month in bills, rent, auto insurance, cell phone, et cetera, et cetera. You have $2,000 per month of outgoing monthly expenses. You should really keep $6,000 to $12,000 in your checking and savings account.
So 3 to 6 months worth of emergency savings, emergency.
Exactly. And that way you're not living paycheck to paycheck. You aren't going to have to rely on credit cards if a sudden bill all of a sudden comes up. And I like to mention something that I kind of coined, and I call it mental zero. Mental zero is where you start to feel uncomfortable when you have too little money.
Ooh, excellent thought. Okay.
Okay, so
I'm starting to think about that myself now.
$2,000 per month, and minimum cash reserve should be $6,000. When if your mental zero should be $6,000. So when you get below $6,000, you're all of a sudden feeling really uncomfortable, and now you're starting to cut things out of your life until you can get back up to the $6,000. And maybe when you get above $12,000, that's where you decide, hey, maybe I'm above my target cash reserve. Now I can maybe splurge on taking a trip to that place I've always wanted to go. Or maybe now I can get that extra pair of shoes that I kind of want but don't really need. So a mental zero, I think, is really, really important.
I like that idea, that mental zero.
Yeah. The fifth financial planning principle is life insurance. And it's something that we don't talk to our friends about, or it doesn't really come up in everyday conversation. But life insurance is really important to have. And if you're single and don't have anybody relying on you, not as much. But when you get married and have kids and have a mortgage and bills and people relying on you, it's pretty important to have. And there's two kinds of insurance. There's term insurance and permanent insurance. Term insurance is generally the cheaper way to go. It requires less cash flow. But term insurance is kind of like renting a house. It doesn't build equity, and it's really there for as long as you pay for it. Permanent insurance is a little bit different. And it builds cash value. It's more permanent. You have to pay for it your whole life, but there are long-term tax benefits to having some permanent life insurance policy if done correctly. How much life insurance is pretty important to know. And I use two goalposts to determine if you have the right amount. The left goalpost says, I need enough life insurance to make sure my beneficiaries are going to be okay if I'm not around. And the right goalpost is, what's my human life value? And it seems maybe just a little weird to say what's a human life value, because we're all priceless.
Sure.
You can't really put a value on our life. But if you happen to pass away, and you might, maybe your economic value to your family can be determined by saying how much money did I make and how far away was I from retirement. So if someone made $50,000 a year and they're 30 years away from retirement, well, not including inflation or future raises, you could say that that person's human life value of their family is $1.5 million.
So those earnings that would have been there.
Yeah, exactly. So an interesting way to think about, there's really no right or wrong on how much insurance to get. It depends on if you're insurable and a lot of different factors, but hopefully that gets people thinking about what an appropriate amount of insurance would be.
Yeah, we certainly don't want to think about death, but we should at least be thinking about those loved ones we'd leave behind. And maybe, I mean, I'd like to think that if I passed away, my wife would grieve. I think she would. Mm-hmm. And be unable to work, or, you know, I'd want her to be there, to her and the kids, to console each other. So I don't, last thing I want her thinking about is, you know, how she's going to pay the mortgage.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what if
and vice versa.
And then, yeah, if you're dependent, you don't want to leave your dependents in a really tough situation with you being gone. Of course, they're going to miss you and nothing could replace you, but why make a harder situation even harder?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
The sixth financial planning principle is estate planning. So I like to bring that up after life insurance. And estate planning is mostly having the right beneficiaries on your accounts and knowing the right questions to ask when it comes to estate planning. So what is a trust? What is a power of attorney? What is a healthcare proxy? What is a will? And how are they different from a trust? So high level view is that a trust will avoid probate on assets. So if someone only had a will and that will said, I want to leave my baseball collection to my brother and I want to leave my house to my sister. Well, they still need to go through the courts to make sure everything gets to where it needs to be. And then you involve attorneys and you involve probate, which can be an expensive process. So having money in having assets named in a trust can help avoid the probate process. And you can also add a power of attorney and healthcare proxy. So power of attorney says, who will make financial decisions for you in the case you can't make them for yourself?
Makes sense.
So something happens, you're unconscious, you're in a hospital, or you just don't have the wherewithal to make your own financial decisions, you can appoint someone to make those decisions for you in what's called a springing power of attorney. So it'll say what conditions need to be met so that someone else can make those decisions for you. And then the same thing for healthcare proxy. Same thing. If you can't make your healthcare decisions for you, you appoint someone. So it's a really good idea to make sure that if you're going to appoint these positions, you want to have someone who's financially savvy for the power of attorney, but then you want to have probably someone who's pretty compassionate for the healthcare proxy.
Makes sense. All right. What do we got next?
The seventh financial planning principle is investing in appreciating assets.
Okay.
This puts a priority over investing into things that will appreciate over time and not depreciate over time. So quick example, homes or real estate generally appreciates over time. It can have its down years,
sure,
or down segments, but in general, it's an appreciating asset. And with COVID aside, we had a weird situation where our car values went up during COVID. That's maybe the first time.
That's certainly not normal.
Very abnormal, but in general, a car is a depreciating asset. Clothing is a depreciating asset. So you don't want to spend too much money on these things. You need them, but you want to keep those investments to a minimum and be smart about investing in the things that appreciate over time.
Makes sense.
The eighth financial planning principle is known as the Einstein's eighth wonder of the world, which is why I made it number eight. It's the compounding interest.
Which kind of goes back to your principle of starting early, right?
Yeah, and this is why you'd want to start early and how you can calculate what you can expect in the future. So the rule of 72 lets us know how quickly our money will double at a given level of interest rate. So luckily we have CDs and accounts that you can now earn risk-free rates of 4-5%, but watch out because you might still have money in a checking or savings account earning less than 1%. But even if something did earn 1%, it would take 72 years for your money to double. You take 72 divided by your interest rate, and that gives you how many years to double. So 72 divided by 1% rate of return, it would take 72 years for that investment to double.
Gotcha.
if you found a CD that's paying 4%, and while I was in Pocatello, I took a little trip down, took down the main drag there and went down Yellowstone Avenue, and I'm starting to see billboards of banks offering CDs for 4 to 5%. So if you can earn your 4% in a CD, 72 divided by 4, it'll only take 18 years for your money to double. So 4% sounds really high compared to 0 or 1, but it's still going to take a really long time for your money to double. 6 to 8% is a return that we generally look for through long-term investing in 401ks, IRAs, mutual funds. And if you can get 8% on your investments over time, it'll take 9 years for your money to double. And if you get really lucky and pick a good stock and you end up earning 12% a year, it only takes 6 years for your money to double. So just to illustrate the compounding power here, let's say someone has 30 years to invest their money and they average a 12% rate of return, and they doubled their money every 6 years for 30 years. Chris, how many times did they double their money?
I think they're doubling it 5, if I'm not mistaken.
5 times, that's exactly right. So if someone invested $1,000 and it doubled 5 times, they didn't turn their money into $5,000.
No.
They doubled it 5 times. So a way different concept. So $1,000 turns into $2,000. That means it doubled once. $2,000 into $4,000 doubled twice. 4,000 into 8,000 is 3 times, and 8 into 16 is 4, and 16 into 32 is when it doubled 5 times. So $1,000 at 12% rate of return over 30 years will turn into $32,000.
I like that.
Pretty amazing. So another reason to start early and get started with that kind of thing is, quite simply, that $1,000 today could be worth $32,000 in the future. And future self is yelling back at you saying, don't spend that $1,000, yeah. Save it, invest it, I need it.
Makes sense. All right, what do we got next?
All right, second to last here is tax planning.
Oh, yeah.
So every year we do our taxes, we prepare our taxes. A lot of people probably do it themselves. They might even use an accountant. But everyone prepares their taxes, and very few people do tax planning. Tax planning is looking out into the future to see what tax bracket you are likely to be in, and then doing something about it. And you might ask, what can I do about it? Well, if it looks like you're going to be in a higher tax bracket down the road, you really don't want to defer your taxes until later. You want to pay the taxes now and get all your money tax-free down the road.
Gotcha.
If you are going to be in a lower tax bracket down the road, you really want to defer paying higher taxes now and pay lower taxes down the road. So that's the point of a 401k, which is a retirement plan through a for-profit corporation or a traditional IRA. You get a tax deduction today, defer all that growth till the future, and then pay the taxes in the future when you're hypothetically in a lower tax bracket. Unfortunately, that doesn't always work out. And people sometimes end up in a higher tax bracket. They deferred in a 15 or 22% bracket, and they forced to pull it out when they're in a 35% bracket.
Yeah, we don't want that. So what's the other option there then?
So the other option is possibly using a Roth IRA. A Roth IRA lets you put after-tax dollars, which means you pay the taxes today, and you get to pull it out tax-free down the road. I generally like a good mix between those investment vehicles, so that you can choose how to take your income down the road. Some in the pre-tax, some in the after-tax.
All right, number 10.
The last financial planning principle is, how do I make my money grow? And the oversimplified answer to this is, get invested, diversify, and stay invested. Get invested, we've talked about that. We talked about starting early, maybe starting a savings plan, out of sight, out of mind. Great way to get invested is allocate a certain percentage of your income that goes right into your retirement plan, right out of your paychecks. Setting up systematically, possibly $100, $200 a month that goes right into an investment, and then it's out of sight, out of mind. It's built in that habit. Diversify, spread your investments among several different asset classes. A lot of times if you have a retirement plan at work, they'll give you a lot of different investment choices. Talk to your financial advisor or someone in charge of that account to get advice on how to do that for you. And then most importantly, stay invested. sometimes when it feels like the worst time to invest, that's usually the best time to invest. And sometimes when it feels like the best time to invest, that could potentially be the worst.
Like going to the car dealership and finding out.
You have to trust that 30 years down the road, America is going to grow, our economy is going to grow, and your investments are going to grow. So don't make emotional decisions about when to invest, but get invested, diversify, stay invested, and enjoy your financial success over the long run.
Yeah, there's some great tips, 10 fantastic tips to follow and live by and eliminate some of the financial stress in your life and look forward to some financial freedom in the future. So.
Yep, well said. Well said.
Well, Ken, really appreciate you being on the show. I wish everyone could have been at your keynote address, again, with the slides, like you said, on radio. We don't get to see the images that you had. You had some fantastic slides to go with it and some fantastic Q&A. But appreciate that you could share all that with us today and wish you the best and hope to have you back again sometime.
Thank you so much, Chris. I had a great time. And to everyone listening, and hope everyone enjoys here some great financial success.
The Bengal Financial Literacy Show, hosted by ISU's Chris Chatwin, can be heard every third Monday at 7:30 p.m. on KISU-FM. Shows are produced at KISU Studios in Pocatello at Idaho State University, with editing for this episode by Ricky Colapietro. Audio of this and all past episodes of Bengal Financial Literacy Show can be found at KISU.org or from Spotify and other select podcast services. Music was produced by Joseph Emanuel under the direction of the ISU Commercial Music Program. Major funding support for KISU local programming comes from the Associated Students of Idaho State University.